content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 3rd, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows John Kelly, President Trump's chief of staff, standing in the foreground, coat and tie. He's got a stern look on his face, and his arms are crossed in kind of a defiant pose. In the background, you can see it's kind of dark, but you can see a coffin that's covered with an American flag. And the headline is "A Costly Conflict: John Kelly, President Trump, and the Political Battle with a Gold Star Family." And we'll get to that in a few minutes. Actually, we'll get to it right away. The main stories and how they were covered. Trump's Gold Star Family dispute. What happened? Escalating the controversy over his treatment of the families of fallen U.S. service members, President Trump this week hit back at the grieving widow of a soldier killed in Niger after she confirmed reports that his condolence call had left her angry and in tears. Maisha Johnson's husband, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, was one of four Special Forces troops who died in an ambush by Islamist militants on October 4th. Johnson told ABC that the president struck a callous tone during their conversation, telling her he knew what he signed up for, and that he repeatedly forgot her husband's name. "That's what hurt me the most," she said. "If my husband is out here fighting for our country, why can't you remember his name?" Trump tweeted that the conversation was very respectful and that he used Johnson's name from the beginning without hesitation. The dispute began last week when the president responded to reporters' questions about his failure to mention the deaths of the soldiers in Niger by falsely claiming that Barack Obama and other presidents often did not contact Gold Star families. Amid growing criticism, Trump called Johnson, who was in a car at the time with Representative Frederica Wilson, Democrat from Florida, a longtime family friend. When Wilson then publicly criticized Trump for upsetting Johnson, he derided her as wacky and called her account a total lie. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, a retired general who lost his own son in Afghanistan, criticized Wilson for listening to the call on speakerphone, but didn't dispute her account of what Trump said, what the editorial said. "The president is so unsuited to his job that he can't even get a condolence call right," said the Los Angeles Times. When his call dismayed Johnson's wife, aunt, and other family members, he insisted that he had proof that Representative Wilson totally fabricated what he'd said. But several people who heard the call said Trump really did make a heartless comment and forgot the dead hero's name, calling him "your guy" instead. "There is something fundamentally flawed about a person who would engage in a war of words with the families of dead soldiers to score political points." Trump didn't mean to upset Johnson in his call, said the Washington Examiner. He was trying to articulate what Kelly had advised him to say, that Johnson was a brave man who was serving his country when he was killed, but expressing delicate sentiments has never been Trump's forte. Even so, the president shouldn't have reacted as he did. When President George W. Bush met the families of slain soldiers, some screamed at him and blamed him for their deaths. Bush stood and took it, often holding them and weeping with them. That's what presidents do. They take the high road. What the columnist said, all Trump had to do was apologize and tell Johnson he hadn't meant any offense, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But his fragile ego will not let him admit any error. As a narcissist, he cannot feel, let alone acknowledge, other people's pain. He sees it as weakness. It's no coincidence that Wilson and Johnson are both black, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Whenever Trump is criticized by a woman of color, he is always more aggressive, more interested in making a spectacle. He knows his supporters feed on racial resentment. Representative Wilson isn't blameless, said David French in NationalReview.com. She should have quietly told the White House that the call had pained Johnson, giving Trump a chance to right the perceived wrong instead of embarrassing him publicly. But the president bears the primary responsibility. By going into his usual attack mode, he made a Gold Star family collateral damage in a political battle. This entire story should deeply grieve Americans. The story should also tell us something important about Trump's view of the military, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. His primary concern when U.S. soldiers die is whether it makes him look bad. On one hand, his fear of damage to his own image might discourage the president from military adventurism. On the other, if he sees an opportunity for some glorious victory for Donald Trump, he probably won't care how many lives are lost. And our controversy of the week brings Kelly's role in the in this incident into play. It's titled Kelly, A Revealing Defense of Trump. White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly was supposed to be one of the, quote, adults in the room, end quote, who'd keep President Trump under control, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. But we just learned there are no adults in the room. In response to a mushrooming scandal over Trump's condolence call to the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, Kelly last week made a rare appearance in the White House briefing room to defend his boss, and only further inflamed an ugly situation. The retired four-star general spoke movingly of his own son, killed in Afghanistan in 2010, and said Johnson's widow misunderstood Trump's meaning when the president said he knew what he signed up for. But Kelly didn't stop there. Instead, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, he launched into a bizarre Trumpian soliloquy about the good old days, when women, religion, and Gold Star families were all held sacred. Kelly then personally attacked Representative Frederica Wilson, the Democratic family friend, who had heard Trump's call to Johnson's widow on a speakerphone. Dismissing Wilson as an empty barrel, Kelly falsely claimed she used a speech commemorating a building named for two fallen FBI agents to brag about her role in getting funds for the project. A video of the event showed this did not happen, but Kelly, like his boss, refused to apologize. Once again, we see that anyone who works for this toxic president winds up morally corrupted. Kelly should certainly address the error regarding Wilson, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. But the rest of his powerful speech changed the game for Trump after days of bad press. By speaking with such deep emotion about the sacrifice of our men and women in uniform, he called them the best 1% this country produces, Kelly steered the conversation into a debate about American values such as patriotism and valor. The haughty mainstream media may not have liked Kelly's unapologetic celebration of our armed forces, said Nicole Russell in TheFederalist.com, but Americans did. We should respect our military, said Richard Cohen in WashingtonPost.com, but we do not owe Kelly slavish veneration. His disdain for the civilians who couldn't possibly understand military sacrifices was palpable in his speech. But the most chilling comment came from Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Deflecting a question about Kelly's smear of Wilson, Sanders said, "If you want to get into a debate with a four-star Marine general, I think that that's something highly inappropriate." Whoa. Are we now governed by a military junta? Soldiers are servants of democracy, said retired Army Colonel Robert Killebrew in foreignpolicy.com, and they fight to protect a free, democratic society in which politicians are held accountable. Kelly and Sanders, much like their authoritarian boss, seem to lack a gut-level understanding of democracy. Kelly's a complicated man, said Elliot Cohen in theatlantic.com. And there were aspects of his speech that almost sounded like an exercise in projection, as a psychologist would say. He expressed pity for those who have never served, while defending a president who dodged the Vietnam draft by claiming to have heel spurs. He lamented the modern lack of respect for women and Gold Star families, while defending a self-declared sexual predator who waged a vendetta against the Gold Star Khan family during the presidential campaign. As he angrily chastised mere civilians for politicizing the death of a soldier, Kelly sounded heartsick. But was he really expressing his misery in serving a man for whom absolutely nothing is sacred? It was a good week for connections. After Montana's Whitefish Energy won a $300 million no-bid contract to rebuild Puerto Rico's electrical grid despite having only two full-time employees, Whitefish was founded by a major donor to President Trump, and the CEO is a friend of U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who grew up in Whitefish. It was a good week for a free press. After the family of a soldier killed in Afghanistan received a $25,000 check from President Trump more than 3 months after he promised it. The check was dated the same day the Washington Post asked the White House why it had not been sent. And it was a good week for living large with the opening of the world's first plus-size beach resort in the Bahamas. The resort features unlimited buffet meals, extra-wide chairs, steel-reinforced beds, and freedom from fat shaming on the beach. But it was a bad week for Prime membership after a Florida couple found 65 pounds of plastic-wrapped marijuana inside a set of plastic bins they had ordered from Amazon.com. The couple turned the weed over to the cops, but fear drug dealers may come after them. It was a bad week for environmental protection after the EPA abruptly canceled an appearance by three agency scientists at a climate change conference in Rhode Island. Conference Chair John King called it a blatant example of the kind of scientific censorship we all suspected. And finally, it was a bad week for the resistance with the announcement that on the anniversary of President Trump's election on November 8th, protesters will gather in Boston and other cities to scream helplessly at the sky. Organizers said screaming together reminds us that we're not alone. And before we move on from this page, there is a boring but important item here. 2017 budget deficit was sixth highest. The federal budget deficit hit $666 billion for the fiscal year 2017, the sixth highest on record. The budget shortfall for the year that ended September 30th was $80 billion higher than in 2016's, an increase of 14%. Federal tax receipts reached a record high, $3.3 trillion, due to improved economic growth. Well, government outlays also hit a record $4 trillion, up 3%, thanks largely to increased spending on Social Security and health care programs, Medicare and Medicaid, and higher interest payments on the national debt. These numbers should serve as a smoke alarm for Washington, a reminder that we need to grow our economy again and get our fiscal house in order, said White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. On the briefing page this week, we have an article titled, Puerto Rico, Lost in Limbo. Puerto Ricans are Americans, but have a vague legal status that will impair the island's recovery. Why is Puerto Rico part of the U.S.? Puerto Ricans had no choice in the matter. A Spanish colony since Ponce de Leon established a settlement there in 1508, Puerto Rico had just acquired voting rights and its own constitution in 1898 when the U.S. invaded the island during the Spanish-American War. The generals promised the locals, descendants of Spanish colonists, former slaves, and indigenous Taino, a free future, and many sided with the U.S. against Spanish rule. But once the war was over and Spain had ceded the island along with the Philippines and Guam, the U.S. did not recognize the local parliament and instead set up a colonial administration. The U.S. president appointed governors who chose their own cabinets. Puerto Rico was effectively a colony and officially a territory. Why isn't it a state? For racial reasons. Most U.S. territories did become states. Oklahoma, for example, became a territory in 1890 and a state in 1907. The difference was that Oklahoma was settled largely by English-speaking whites who displaced the Native Americans. Starting in 1901, the same Supreme Court that had approved separate but equal segregation for black Americans in the infamous Plessy versus Ferguson case ruled in a series of decisions that Puerto Rico and other territories that were inhabited by alien races were not ready to be governed by Anglo-Saxon principles. Puerto Rico was declared an unincorporated territory, different from the Alaskan and Hawaiian incorporated territories, and a path to statehood was closed off. Unlike Plessy versus Ferguson, the insular cases, as these rulings are known, were never overturned. Can Puerto Ricans vote? Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens from birth, thanks to a law passed in 1917, partly aimed at allowing them to serve in the Army during World War I. But they have no voting representation in Congress, and they can't vote for president unless they move to the mainland. While they don't pay federal income taxes, Puerto Ricans do pay some $3 billion annually to the federal government in Medicare, Social Security, and other taxes. They are eligible for U.S. public assistance programs and receive about $20 billion a year in such aid, with 40% of the poverty-stricken population getting food stamps. After World War II, when colonies around the world were gaining independence, Congress allowed Puerto Rico to write and adopt its own constitution with its own Bill of Rights. That constitution calls Puerto Rico a commonwealth, but the legal status of that term was never quite nailed down, leaving it in limbo. Why does that hurt the island? The biggest problem is that Puerto Ricans can't fully control its own economy. During the first few decades under U.S. administration, authorities imposed a colonial structure of sugar plantations, which hurt other local industries. In the 1970s and 80s, the territory benefited from U.S. tax exemptions that encouraged pharmaceutical firms and other corporations to locate there. But when Congress started phasing those out in 1996, manufacturing declined and the economy tanked. The territory's elected leaders began making up the shortfall by issuing bonds, creating a ballooning debt of more than $70 billion. Bankruptcy rules that allow cities such as Detroit to restructure debt don't apply to Puerto Rico. And rather than change that, Congress passed the PROMESA law last year, creating an oversight board that took financial control entirely away from local authority and imposed severe austerity. What status do Puerto Ricans want? They are divided. Some want statehood, some independence, and others a Commonwealth option that would allow them to retain U.S. citizenship, but enable them to make their own treaties with foreign countries. There's no majority for any of the options. The latest vote was this past June, but most factions boycotted. The result was a 97% vote for statehood, but with turnout of just 23%. The devastation from Hurricane Maria, though, may change the island forever. Already, the Puerto Ricans on the mainland, some 5 million, outnumbered the island's population of 3.4 million. With 80% of people still lacking power, 30% without water, and thousands of businesses destroyed, many Puerto Ricans with the means to leave are fleeing to the mainland. What's Puerto Rico's future? Right now, it looks grim. Puerto Ricans are furious at what they see as a slow FEMA response, as well as at President Trump's insinuation that they, unlike hurricane victims in Texas and Florida, will have to pay back any aid they receive. Activists are putting pressure on Congress to relax the rules that deny Puerto Rico the resources a state would have. The Jones Act, which bars foreign ships from delivering goods to the island, has been temporarily waived, but could be repealed. Debt restructuring is under discussion. Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello warns that without significant aid to rebuild the island's infrastructure, reduce its debt, and revive its economy, there will be a mass exodus. You're not going to get hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans moving to the States, Rossello said. You're going to get millions. Time now to read a few of the best columns of the week. The first is from the U.S., The Twilight of Political Parties, from David Vondrell at the Washington Post. Both of America's major political parties are in crisis, said David Vondrell. Despite controlling Congress, the White House, and most state governments, Republicans have become so fractured they may not even be able to rally around tax cuts, the golden calf of the GOP. Their president feels he owes zilch to the party after defeating a host of primary candidates representing every Republican faction, and he often attacks other Republicans. The internal bloodletting is at least as fierce on the Democratic side. The party nearly lost control of its own presidential nomination last year to Senator Bernie Sanders, a socialist independent who continues to galvanize the left wing against leading Democrats. In the modern era, voters no longer need, nor in many cases want, a political party to screen their candidates and vet their ideas. Just as it has disrupted the retail industry, the digital revolution has allowed outsider and extremist candidates to bypass traditional gatekeepers to connect directly with voters and donors. It's true that both parties have been arrogant, unresponsive, and borderline corrupt. But the parties also vetted and trained candidates and helped enable the compromises needed to govern. We may miss them, when they are gone. This column comes from Poland. Will one man's suicide wake us up? A Polish man's self-immolation has shocked the nation, said Jan Hartman. The 54-year-old, not yet named by authorities, died last week after setting himself on fire outside the Palace of Culture in Warsaw. He left behind a manifesto of protest against the increasing authoritarianism of the ruling Law and Justice Party. I love freedom first, and that is why I decided to immolate myself, the letter said. I hope that my death will shake the consciences of many people. It has already shaken mine. Poland seems to have transported back to 1968, when 59-year-old Ryszard Siwik set himself alight to protest Poland's participation in the brutal suppression of the Prague Spring by Warsaw Pact forces. That martyrdom led to political demonstrations, and Siwik is honored as a Polish hero to this day. One who helped Poles see that they could resist their communist leaders. Now this brave man in Warsaw has tried to call our attention to the creeping repression that has set in since nationalist Law and Justice came to power in 2015, with courts politicized and the press placed under state control. Some of us have joined street protests, but most of us have done nothing or almost nothing to save Polish democracy, which we won back only 27 years ago. Will this man's sacrifice wake up Polish society from its lethargy and complacency? And finally, one from China. Xi positions himself as the new Mao. Xi Jinping is now officially China's supreme leader, said Nectar Gan in the South China Morning Post. At the Communist Party Congress in Beijing this week, party officials vied with one another to praise the Chinese president, glorifying his achievements with gushing superlatives, even calling him Ling Su, a term for absolute leader rarely used since the time of Chairman Mao. That such accolades were bestowed at the Congress, which takes place every 5 years, shows the party's elite have agreed to hand Xi total and possibly indefinite authority over ideology, politics, and the military. The party's constitution was even rewritten to include Xi Jinping, thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. By labeling Xi's political philosophy thought, the Congress gave it the same standing as Mao Zedong thought, written into the Constitution in 1945, and placed it above Deng Xiaoping theory, the doctrine added after Deng's 1997 death. Alas, Xi seems to have more in common with the economically and socially disastrous Mao than with the overachieving pragmatist Deng, said the Economic Times. His acquisition of absolute power has come from a series of purges dressed up as anti-corruption drives. Other party bigwigs fear him because any of them could easily be brought down by a graft allegation. After all, self-dealing was a byproduct of the rapid economic growth set in motion by Deng's reforms in the late 1970s. Xi, though, learned from Deng's mistake. He won't allow the emergence of any non-state-dependent bourgeoisie that might demand political power or try to protest in Tiananmen Square. Instead, he is putting the party at the center of every aspect of Chinese life. Government, military, society, and schools, Xi said at the Congress, north, south, east, and west. The party is leader of all. Xi has announced a paradigmatic shift in China's focus, said the China Daily. During 40 years of spectacular growth, the party lifted millions out of poverty, and the skylines of many Chinese coastal cities have grown to dwarf those in Europe. China now has one-third of the world's billionaires. But the affluence has not been shared equally, and rapid industrialization has come at a high cost to the environment. A better life for most Chinese people now means not just a higher income, but also a more equitable distribution of wealth, a just society, and a cleaner environment. Those are the domestic challenges Z vows to overcome. But it's Z's foreign policy that's most troubling, said Meriden Verral in the Australian Financial Review. His speech to the Congress was liberally peppered with not-so-subtle references to the declining role of the U.S. and its unpredictable president. As America withdraws from the world, China is moving to fill the void. Z differs from his Chinese predecessors in his willingness to assume leadership on a world stage. And he's made it clear that China will be increasingly disinclined to accept international norms or rules it did not create. It's Z's world now. Our in-depth article this week is titled, Inmates Who Fight Fires. Women serving time in California prisons are routinely deployed to fight the state's wildfires, said Jamie Lowe. For less than $2 an hour, they do strenuous and dangerous work with relatively little training. Shauna Lynn Jones climbed from the back of a red truck with L.A. County Fire printed on its side. 10 more women piled out after her on the border of Agoura Hills and Malibu in Southern California. They could see flames in the vicinity of Mulholland Highway from a fire that had been burning for about an hour. Jones and her crew wore helmets and yellow Nomex fire retardant suits. Yellow handkerchiefs covered their mouths and necks. Each carried 50 pounds of equipment in her backpack. As the second saw, Jones was one of the two women who carried a chainsaw. She was also one of California's 250 or so female inmate firefighters. Jones worked side by side with Jessica Ornelas, the second bucker, who collected whatever wood Jones cut down. Together, they were responsible for setting the line, which meant clearing potential fuel from a six-foot-wide stretch of ground between whatever was burning and the land they were trying to protect. If they did their job right, a fire might be contained, but any number of things could go quickly wrong. A slight wind shift, the fall of a burning tree, and the fire would jump the brake. It was just after 3 a.m. on February 25, 2016, when Malibu 13-3, the 12-woman crew Jones belonged to, arrived at Mulholland Fire, ahead of any aerial support or local fire trucks. The inmates, including men, roughly 4,000 prisoners, fight wildfires alongside civilian firefighters throughout California, immediately went to work. They opened in hook line formation, moving in order of rank, which was determined by task and ability. The first saw, or hook, leads. The second saw is next. Mulholland was Jones' first fire as second saw. She'd been promoted the previous week. It took only 4 months for captains to notice her after she began training, and she quickly rose from the back of the hook line, where all inmates start, to the front. This part of Southern California is full of ravines and dry brush. Season after season, its protected lands are prone to landslides, flash floods, and wildfires. The women scrambled over a slope that was full of loose soil and rocks, which made digging the containment line, a trench of sorts, even more challenging. It was very steep, Tykesha Brown, a crew member, told me. The fire was jumping. With every step they took forward, it felt as if they were slipping at least one step back. By 7:30 a.m., a little more than a third of the fire was considered contained. Malibu 13-3 had done its job. The fire didn't jump the line. It didn't threaten homes, ranches, or coastal properties. By 10 the next morning, Jones was dead. She was 22. Her 3-year sentence had less than 2 months to go. California's inmate firefighters choose to take part in the dangerous work they do. They have to pass a fitness test before they can qualify for fire camps. But once they are accepted, the training they receive, which often lasts as little as 3 weeks, is significantly less than the 3-year apprenticeship that full-time civilian firefighters get. Any fire you go on statewide, whether it be small or large, the inmate hand crews make up anywhere from 50 to 80% of the total fire personnel, said Lieutenant Keith Rady, the commander in charge of a camp where women train. When they work, California's inmates typically earn between 8 and 95 cents an hour. They make office furniture for state employees, license plates, and prison uniforms. But wages in the forestry program, while still wildly low by outside standards, are significantly better than the rest. At Malibu 13, one of 3 conservation camps that house women, inmate firefighters can make a maximum of $2.56 a day in camp and $1 an hour when they're fighting fires. Those higher wages recognize the real dangers that inmate firefighters face. In May, one man was crushed by a falling tree in Humboldt County. In July, another firefighter died after accidentally cutting his leg and femoral artery on a chainsaw. But after visiting 3 camps over a year and a half, I could see why inmates would accept the risks. Compared with life among the general prison population, the conservation camps are bastions of civility. They are less violent. They smell of eucalyptus, the ocean, fresh blooms. They have woodworking areas, softball fields, and libraries full of donated mysteries and romance novels. Still, when they're at work, the inmates look like chain gangs without the chains, especially in Malibu, where the average household income is $238,000. The pay is ridiculous, LaSonia Edwards, 35, told me. There are some days we are worn down to the core, she said. Edward makes about $500 a year in camp, plus whatever she earns while on the fire line, which might add up to a few hundred dollars in a month. The pay for a full-time civilian firefighter starts at about $40,000. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says the firefighter program, known as the Conservation Camp Program, is meant to serve as a rehabilitation for inmates. Yet Los Angeles County Fire won't hire felons, and CDCR doesn't offer any formal help to inmates who want firefighting jobs when they're released. The Conservation Camp Program saves California taxpayers approximately $100 million a year. Several states, including Arizona, Nevada, Wyoming, and Georgia, employ prisoners to fight fires, but none of them relies as heavily on its inmate population as California does. In 2015, Governor Jerry Brown told a local CBS affiliate, "It's very important when we can quantify that manpower. Utilize it. I lost count," Marquette Jones, 27, a firefighter arrested for his first-degree burglary, told me when I asked her how many fires she had been on over the past year. "I don't know how many fires there were last season, but all through last season." She recalled her first fire last year, going into Napa Valley as residents were evacuating. The town was burned over. She wondered what she had gotten herself into. Despite her fear, she cut the containment line for 10 hours, almost until dawn. The heavy labor and danger create a bond among the crew members. Of the 30 or so women I met, most were serving prison terms because of drug or alcohol-related crimes, nonviolent convictions that the state classifies as low level. Many said the real education they were getting had to do with making and maintaining relationships. "It helps you to work as a sister crew," Marquette said. "You learn how to work with them, you know, because really all you have is each other." Some inmates say they would work the fire line for free, for the experience, the training, the gratification of doing something useful. "It feels good," Marquette said, "when you see kids with signs saying, 'Thank you for saving my house.' Thank you for saving my dog. It feels good that you saved somebody's home, you know. Some people, they look down on us just because we're inmates. Shauna Lynn Jones didn't grow up with dreams of being a firefighter. She wanted to be a police officer. The first photo her mom, Diana Baez, showed me was of a cocky young girl of around 5 or 6, dressed up for a career day. Jones is wearing navy blue head to toe and aviator shades. She always wanted to be a canine handler, and here she was dressed like one, Baez said. We were sitting in a dark wood-paneled bar, The Trap, a dusty oasis on the fringes of Lancaster, a town already on the fringes of Southern California. Before Jones was incarcerated, this was her home. Her mom managed the bar. Jones was smart, but as a teenager, she couldn't sit still in class. Eventually, she dropped out of high school. She had a string of boyfriends, most of them bad, and in May 2014, she was caught sitting in a car next to one of them and a large quantity of crystal methamphetamine. He had a lengthy record and didn't want to be locked up for life. He told Jones he would bail her out if she took responsibility for the drugs. Jones was convicted of possession with attempt to distribute methamphetamine and a marijuana possession. The boyfriend paid the $30,000 bail, and Jones was sentenced to 3 years probation. Within a year, Jones was back in trouble. She had violated parole at least 3 times, stealing groceries, selling marijuana, missing court dates, before a warrant was issued for her arrest. Jones decided to turn herself in. The Trap hosted a party. We basically ordered 1 million tacos so that she would remember what real food tastes like, said Rosa Garcia, Jones' friend. By the next day, she was ready. Jones hugged her mom and skated off on a longboard toward Lancaster Courthouse. Jones was sentenced to 3 years. She heard about the forestry program and was transferred to Malibu. By November 2015, Jones was calling her mom weekly to tell her about the training, the exhaustion after sandbagging a hillside, and the optional weekend hikes through the canyons of Malibu. She had found something she liked in the work. Her enthusiasm was so great, it convinced her mother that Jones' luck was changing. On the morning of the Mulholland fire, February 25th, an unknown number flashed on Baez's cell phone. There's been an accident, a man told her when she answered. Baez, immediately hysterical, asked, "Where is my daughter?" He said, "I can't tell you because she's an inmate." An hour later, when the Lancaster Sheriff's Office called with instructions, Baez scrawled as much information as she could on her bedroom mirror using eyeliner. When she got to the UCLA hospital, she found her daughter lying unconscious. "The first thing I did when I opened that curtain and saw her, I grabbed her. Right there, I grabbed her. I said, 'You promised me,' Baez told me. She just called me 2 days before, and she said, 'Mama, I'm coming home in 6 weeks.'" Baez hardly recognized her daughter. Her face was swollen. Her eyes were taped shut. Her head had been shaved because the doctors were trying to drain a blood clot. Captains and representatives from CDCR tried to explain what happened, but Baez could only cry. She never left Jones. Later, she found out from the intake administrator what had happened on the ravine in Malibu. The earth above Jones began giving way. The first chainsaw shouted rock, but Jones couldn't hear over the noise of her machine. The large stone fell 100 feet and struck her head. She was knocked out. A fire captain strapped her into a stretcher, and a helicopter retrieved the limp body. At a graduation last year of inmate firefighters at the California Institution for Women near Chino, where all female inmate firefighters are trained, the mood was celebratory, almost exultant. One speaker brought up Jones and asked, to great applause, that her life and death not go in vain. He said she gave her life for this program, and L.A. County made sure she did not leave without full dress. Jones' body was driven from the coroner's department to Eternal Valley Memorial Park and Mortuary, located between Lancaster and Los Angeles. A fire company crew was on every overpass, standing on their trucks, saluting in full uniform. Outside her funeral, rows of sheriffs and deputies stood at attention, right hands at their brows. Two fire trucks were parked at the entrance with their ladders raised, crossed in tribute to her. Shauna Lynn Jones lived as an inmate and died as an honored firefighter. Baez received a customary American flag folded into a tight triangle. Someone told her, she says, that in Shauna's 4 months as a firefighter, she made about $1,000. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times magazine. Going to read a business column that has some local interest. Issue of the week, vying for Amazon's new headquarters. Tucson sent a 21-foot cactus to Jeff Bezos. Birmingham, Alabama installed giant delivery boxes around town. And Stonecrest, Georgia offered to rename itself Amazon. When you're gunning to be the home of Amazon's second headquarters, you need something to set yourself apart, said Nathan Bomey in USA Today. After the e-commerce giant announced in September that it was hunting for the perfect Amazon HQ2 location, promising to invest $5 billion and create 50,000 high-paying jobs, 238 cities and towns eagerly threw their hats into the ring, with the application period ending last week. Some launched downright wacky stunts, while others dangled more traditional sweeteners, like the $7 billion in tax breaks offered up by Newark, New Jersey. If there are early front runners for this civic beauty pageant, Amazon isn't saying, said Matt Day in SeattleTimes.com. But based on the company's lengthy wish list, a population of at least 1 million, good mass transit, and well-educated labor force, analysts have some guesses. Moody's Analytics crunched the numbers and named Austin, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Rochester, New York as, quote, best positioned to win. Cities in the running should be careful what they wish for, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times. Well before Amazon disrupted books, music, television, furniture, everything, it disrupted Seattle. Here in the home of its first headquarters, Amazon has detonated a prosperity bomb. Sure, we got tens of thousands of high-paying jobs, but the median home price has doubled in the past 5 years to $700,000. The traffic is maddening, and Amazon occupies a full fifth of our best office space. The company has quite simply altered our city in ways residents never had any say over. The victor will no doubt have to fork over billions in tax breaks, said Katie Steinmetz in Time.com. That's likely to be a raw deal for locals, because when a company attracts new people to a region, public costs, hiring more teachers, fielding more 9/11 calls, widening roadways, often rise substantially. If Amazon gets a pass on contributing, residents will be rewarded with a higher tax bill. I think it's obnoxious for a healthy company to insist on getting these enticements, said Robert Reed in the Chicago Tribune. But it's now a fact of corporate life. If one city doesn't play ball, another one will. But in this case, the benefits outweigh the publicly backed giveaways. Chicago's bid estimates that Amazon could generate $341 billion for the local economy over the next 17 years. Still, I'd like to appeal to Jeff Bezos' higher, better angels, said Virginia Postrel in Bloomberg.com. Does he want to be a responsible corporate citizen and use this opportunity to challenge civic leaders to create better cities for residents? Or does he want Amazon to go looking for handouts? As it weighs its many options, Amazon should consider what its high-profile decision says about its values, priorities, and identity. And we'll finish out on the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled Raqqa's Fall, the End of ISIS. History will record that the Islamic State Caliphate survived for 3 years, 3 months, and some 18 days, said Robin Wright in TheNewYorker.com. At its height, the barbaric terrorist group controlled an area in Iraq and Syria the size of Indiana, with 8 million people living under its rule of perverted viciousness. But 4 months after retaking Mosul in Iraq, U.S.-backed militias last week captured the Syrian city of Raqqa, ISIS' de facto capital. This isn't the end of the war. ISIS fighters still have outposts in lawless parts of eastern Syria, Libya, Sinai, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. Their zealotry will endure. But the fall of Raqqa clearly marks the symbolic demise of ISIS rule. Fears that thousands of Westerners who join the group will now flood home and wage jihad may not come to pass, said Graham Wood in TheAtlantic.com. Many of them died in the ferocious U.S. bombing. Meanwhile, the U.S. allied coalition isn't taking many prisoners, preferring that no one makes it back alive. Rather than declaring ISIS defeated, counterterrorism officials are bracing for a new lethal incarnation of the jihadist group, said Margaret Coker in the New York Times. Its leaders have already signaled that they plan to revert to their roots as a guerrilla force. The group can also continue using its powerful social media network to inspire and coordinate terrorist attacks across the globe. That may be true, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com, but the claim to be an authentic Islamic State was critical to ISIS's international appeal. Without that distinctive brand, the group will probably be reduced to a shadowy terrorist network, as marginal as Al-Qaeda after the death of Osama bin Laden. Still, it would be foolish to throw any victory parade, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. Remember how the surge seemed to defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq a decade ago, before the group reemerged as ISIS? Today, Iraq remains on the brink of civil war, with Iraqi government troops last week seizing the city of Kirkuk from Iraqi Kurds and Shiite militias persecuting Sunnis. Syria is also fractured among myriad militias and rebel groups, some friendly to U.S. interests, some not. The region remains utterly chaotic, and the U.S. will have to keep troops there indefinitely. That's why the fall of Raqqa feels so anticlimactic. Bush sounding the alarm on Trump. Neither of them mentioned President Trump by name, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. But last week, two of his predecessors emerged from political seclusion to deliver a bipartisan rebuke of the current occupant of the Oval Office. Barack Obama voiced his own alarm at the current politics of division and fear, but it was George W. Bush's withering critique of Trumpism that was the landmark event, said Brent Badowski in TheHill.com. In a powerful speech at the Spirit of Liberty conference, the former Republican president lamented the bigotry and casual cruelty of the Trumpian discourse and the way nationalism has been distorted into nativism. The 43rd president left no doubt that he believes the 45th is to blame. When we lose sight of our ideals, it is not democracy that has failed, Bush said. It is the failure of those charged with preserving and protecting democracy. For this, Bush has gotten and will get plenty of praise, and deservedly so, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. But before we start lionizing W as a representative of the nobler age and nobler GOP, let's not forget his own record. Bush dragged the country into a disastrous war in Iraq, made torture the official policy of the U.S., exploded the deficit with a massive tax cut for the wealthy, and left the economy in shambles. Trump won partly because he capitalized on Bush's mistakes, said Raihan Salam in Slate.com. He vowed to avoid costly foreign wars, and his popular economic nationalism was directly fueled by Bush's decision to pursue open immigration and free trade at the expense of the Rust Belt's white working class. Put simply, had there been no Bush, there'd be no Trump. Given Trump's bottomless need for validation, the Bush-Obama joint criticism has to sting, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. It's unprecedented for two former presidents to break the traditional code of silence and turn on their club's newest member, an indication they are deeply alarmed by Trump's divisive rhetoric and erratic leadership. But will their criticism hurt him politically? Probably not. His base, in fact, may see it as validation. After all, what better endorsement could there be of anti-establishment campaign targeting Washington elites than running foul of the two previous presidents from each political party? And a short note or two, North Korea's nuclear test may have become so big that they've undermined the geological structure of Mount Mantap, the 7,200-foot-high peak under which the rogue state detonates its devices. Analysts say further tests could cause the mountain to implode and release plumes of radiation. Pollution in all its forms killed 9 million people globally in 2015 and led to $4.6 trillion in damage, according to researchers at the Lancet Commission on Pollution and Health. And finally, a quote from Mark Twain, "Against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.